very happy Friday afternoon. Hey, hey, congrats. You've made it to Friday afternoon. I can smell the weekend coming pretty quickly. Paul Nolte joins us now. First guest today's Wintrust Business Lunch. He's the Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist at Murphy & Sylvestre. Paul, as always, it's good to talk to you, my friend.
Nice to be with you again.
We had some inflation data today that was in line with expectations, which after a couple of weird months, I think we'll take in line with expectations, right, Paul?
Yeah, in this case, you know, that's the interesting part of the PCE, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. It is a mouthful. It is the Fed's favorite way to take a look at inflation. But a lot of the data points get released with the producer prices and the consumer prices. So people are able to kind of figure out what the producer price index or the PCE should be. And so that's why, generally speaking, those come in line with expectations.
Oh, that's interesting that the CPI is maybe a little bit more volatile, or I don't want to say more, but more different from what the expectations are. Same with the PPI. But once people have seen those two, the last one kind of is maybe a little bit more easy to tell what's going to happen. But we'll still take it in line with expectations.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it is getting toward that 2% range. We're still a ways away, and we still have economic, you know, the growth part of the economy to deal with, but it's starting to get there. Is it fast enough for the Fed? Can we avoid a recession? Will they have to raise rates if commodity prices stay high? Those are still, I think, questions that are fairly open at this point. We'll get some more color in a couple of weeks when the Fed meets next.
Can you zoom out a little bit and just tell the tale of inflation from the last year, right? I think 2023 was about falling inflation. And what, the first couple months countered that a bit? Walk us through it a little bit, where we've been on this journey.
Yeah, it's been all over the place. The beginning part of last year, inflation rates were relatively low, 0.1, 0.2 on a monthly basis. And they ramped up into the fall and have come down a little bit. We're going to, if we get 0.2, 0.3, we might actually see the annualized numbers go up because we're going to lose those very low numbers from last year. That being said, the inflation rate is coming down. It doesn't necessarily mean that prices are coming down. So the rate of increase in prices is slowing. That means prices are still going up, but just at a slower pace.
Right. And I know people like itch for lower prices to come down. But Paul, as I'm often reminded by smart people like you, sure, it might provide some like immediate satisfaction if the price of the things you buy goes down. But like broadening out, that's not a trend we want to see in over any long period of time, right?
Well, you know, again, when we take a look at the spike that we got in inflation coming out of COVID, we've really just moderated a little bit at a 3% annual rate. So if you take a look at that and say, okay, prices are going up at 3% a year, is that okay relative to my earnings? If my earnings are growing at 4-6% a year, okay, that's not so bad. The other component to inflation, though, too, is it is personalized. It kind of depends on where you're at in your life, in your career, et cetera. My kids are older. They're out of the house. You may have younger kids going into college, so education is a big deal. For me being older, healthcare is going to be a big deal. So it hits everybody differently depending upon where they're at in their lifespan. So again, inflation is a little bit different for everybody, depending on what you're spending on. But again, we'd like to see some of those prices come back down again to levels that we're familiar with, and that will start to make people feel a little bit better about where they're at economically.
Paul Nolte, he is the Senior Wealth Advisor at Murphy and Sylvestre, murphysylvestre.com. Unofficially into summer here, Paul, and I'm not asking you to look into the crystal ball. I guess look in the past. Is summer sleepy on the markets, up and down, or and there's no real trend lines to pull?
Well, you know, when you come into, and again, the answer to all financial questions is identical. It depends. And it depends on whether it's an election year, as we have today. The market tends to trend a little sideways until we get past the various conventions, and then we start to see a little bit of a sell-off coming into the election and then a rally after the election. In a typical year, the summer months tend to be a little bit on the sideways pattern. Again, a lot of traders head for the beaches, the Hamptons, wherever else. And so we tend to see a little bit more of a sideways pattern. Volume tends to tail off a little bit, but we have seen in the last couple years, the summertime volume really doesn't decline too terribly much from where it does the other parts of the year.
Is that because of the democratization of stocks? Like everyone can be a participant now?
And that's part of it. I think part of it, too, is while you're at the Hamptons, the computer is doing all the trading for you. So we do have a lot of automated trading. So you'll see it a lot. And here's the example, you know, Fed Day coming up in a couple of weeks. As soon as they release, they make the release of the of their comment, or Chair Powell happens to say something during the commentary afterwards, a press conference afterwards, you'll see the markets really move quickly. And it's a lot faster than you and I can probably hit the computer to say, buy or sell shares. It's the computer that's reading the information and making a judgment based on that.
Wait, it reads the transcript or it reads what is happening? Really?
Yeah. Yes. So you have the automated trading that's going on based on what happens. So that's why you get a knee-jerk reaction in the mornings when you get big economic data, like this morning's PCE indicator. You get that immediate reaction because it's looking for certain things. It knows what the baseline is, and if it's above that, it could be good, could be bad. If it's below it, same thing.
Right. I mean, I knew people reacted to it, and you know, they logged in and they hit their numbers on their phone, but you're telling me there is automation systems that read those transcripts in real time or read those numbers when they're released and make immediate decisions to try and capitalize either on a buy or a sell moment?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the computerization. That's that the algorithmic trading that goes on. And it goes on a little bit overnight, but a lot of it during the open hours on New York Stock Exchange.
Does that help explain why sometimes we see the knee-jerk reaction, then a couple minutes later, it's almost like the humans have come back to the table and maybe they read it a little differently. They dive deeper into the data. They find something that maybe, oh, wait, this is good news. Maybe the incomes went up a little more than expected. Is that why we have the knee-jerk first and then the settling afterwards?
That's generally true. And I'll go back to the Fed's announcement day. So after the press conference, you get a lot of volatility during the press conference, and the market may finish higher on that particular day. Everybody sleeps on it overnight, and then comes back to the trading floor the next day and goes, you know, on further review, maybe we want to do something a little different. And so you're right. It is a very much a knee-jerk reaction and a little bit more thought process occurs later on, and that tends to be in an opposite direction.
That's fascinating. Okay. At least I found that fascinating. For most people out there that are listening, you know, they got their 401ks, maybe they're approaching retirement. I get these questions a lot. Oh, should I, you know, we've had such a good run. Should I be selling off part of it? And Paul, you're not able to answer that. I mean, this is all, every individual needs to take a look at their next 3 months, 6 months, 6 years, 10 years to make those determinations, right?
No, that's true. And part of it, though, too, is what you don't need. And we see this a lot where you have your 401k. I started at the company 20 years ago. I picked this fund and this fund, and I haven't looked at it since. Yeah. And you want to go back every 6 months, maybe every year, change your contribution until you get to the maximum level and rebalance. That's one of the key things that you really want to do. Maybe you've been invested in technology the last 10 years and it's had a great run. Is it going to have that same type of run the next 10 years? Probably not. So good thing to take a look at the 401k and rebalance back to some type of a target, whether it's a 50-50 or a 60-40 or whatever that might be. But you want to be looking at your 401k more than every 5 to 10 years.
Right. You know, we talk to a lot of people that seem skeptical about going to a wealth advisor because they feel like, well, I've already done so much for myself already, and look at how much I've built, I'm okay. And you know, that's maybe true. And in fact, those are a lot of the people who should be going to wealth advisors. You've built this what you have, and then it's like kind of navigating the landing. We talked about the soft landing a lot with the Fed. How about everyone's own soft landing into retirement and beyond?
And that is the biggest thing that a wealth advisor is going to benefit you is, should I take Social Security early? Should I take money out of my IRA versus my personal account? How much should I take out? Should I start taking that out now before I take Social Security? Managing taxes. A lot of those types of things are much more important than, did I buy 100 shares of Microsoft or NVIDIA? It's now, how do I go about spending down what I have and making sure that it's going to last me until I'm 100, 105, who knows? We're all living longer. And that's one of the things that a lot of people don't think about is, you know, I'm going to be like my parents or grandparents and pass away in my 70s. We are all living much, much longer. We want to make sure that that money lasts as long as possible. And if you can and want to, pass it along to your beneficiaries in a very tax efficient way.
Right. You know, Paul, I meant to mention this the next time I talk to you. I know you were quoting someone else, but I've used the quote that you use for someone else about, if you touch the soap too much, you have less of it. I think you were the one that introduced me to that idea that a retirement account is a lot like the bar of soap. Sometimes you don't want to touch it, but, you know, maybe you have someone look over it for you.
You do. And, you know, like I said, it's one of those, and what a lot of people think about is, you know, I'm putting all this money into the IRA account, my 401k. But remember that the government is participating in the appreciation of that. So maybe take a look at a Roth, or maybe do some of the conversion. Realize that you're going to pay tax. You're always going to pay tax. And in retirement, it's trying to minimize the tax that you pay, because now we have to look at Medicare and a lot of other things that come into play.
Yeah.
So there are reasons to, when you get to retirement, I have a few clients where we do this. We take the IRA out first and we leave the other assets alone because the IRA comes out at a much better tax rate.
Interesting.
And then we take a look at, again, passing it on to beneficiaries.
Right, because maybe the conventional wisdom, oh, use your Roth first. But I see what you're saying. That's interesting. Paul, we're out of time. I appreciate your guidance. Murphy and Sylvest, MurphySylvest.com. We'll do it again soon, Paul, okay?
Look forward to it. Thank you.
It's John for John, taking you till 2. We will do the bright side of life in the next hour. So start thinking, start getting ready to call. We'll also take more of your goals for the summer, summer promises, summer bucket list, whatever you want to call it. It's just one thing you absolutely want to do this summer. Maybe I'll start there with Tom Appel. I like asking that question. Tom Appel, our good friend from Consumer Guide Automotive, a frequent guest of all the programs at WGN, let's just say it as it is. Tom, welcome back to the Winter's Business Lunch.
Well, thank you.
What are you going to do this summer? What's your one thing on the list?
Well, you know, my daughter just graduated from grad school, so we're so relieved. I don't know that we have plans yet, but
it already happened. You got it. You did it.
Yeah, I got my summer wish.
Congratulations
to her.
You wrote Why Tesla Sales Are Tanking. First, can you just set up just how far the tank has come?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, but Tesla's momentum, which seemed almost immeasurable for so long, Tesla sales just kept increasing, people kept buying Teslas, and starting late last year and into this year, Tesla started to run into some sales issues. For April, they did 60,000 units last year in the U.S. That was down to 54,000 units in the U.S. this year for April. And the market was up 15%. So it's an incredible slide because finally there's a bunch of reasons, but one of the other reasons is there's reasonable competition out there.
So the market of buying EVs was up, but not Teslas. Those were down 10%.
Yep.
Okay, well, I have a really this is a basic question. Tesla was the only player in the game for a long time. Clearly,
yes,
that was never going to last. EVs were going to continue to grow in popularity, and they haven't really updated all that much. I guess the question is how come no one at Tesla didn't see this coming from miles away?
I think it was a question of inertia and just sort of like positive thinking. They had so much growth. Tesla added 2 factories in the last few years, one in Berlin, Germany, and one in Austin, Texas, so that clearly they believed that the sales increase was going to continue. They added all this capacity, so it looked like they thought they were on a path to just almost never-ending growth.
Part of the story is also the idea of Tesla having their factories in China, and that in and of itself was a smart move by the Chinese government, who wanted to almost spurn on electric competition within their own country, which now, coming full circle, has become a competition for Elon Musk, maybe not in the United States, but elsewhere too.
The China situation is interesting because the China factory in Shanghai is absolutely huge. It's one of the largest auto plants in the world, and it's capable of producing nearly a million vehicles a year. And the tides have turned for Tesla in China just as they have in the U.S. The public there has gotten very interested in the homegrown EVs, which have become much better. The cars are very good. The competition is real now. So Tesla is struggling to keep that factory running at anywhere near capacity. And there's an industry standard that if a factory isn't running at roughly 80% capacity or higher, it's probably losing money.
And what was the number at? Do you know what the number is they're at?
I'm sorry, for the factory, the plant capacity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about a million units. It's a huge factory.
Okay. All right, so their product is old. In terms of just it hasn't been updated. You know, I think some people might say, and they're also too expensive. Hey, cut those prices. Then you'll move more product. Have they tried that, and does it work?
Yeah, so two things there, right? The old products are interesting because there are 5 million Tesla owners globally who do not have a reason to return to Tesla for a new car because the car they have is very much like the car they're offering. And the price cuts, which began last year, have been very damaging to the resale value of the vehicles that are out there. And I've spoken to owners personally who are just so frustrated that their resale values have plummeted. So that makes it even harder to turn around and buy a new car because your car is worth less in trade-in value.
Interesting. So price cuts haven't worked. What's the future then? What is Tesla's ace in the hole to try and get out of this?
That's an interesting question, and the answer isn't clear. One of the things that Tesla had talked about for a very long time was a new product, and it was going to be a $25,000 car. And we know that if Tesla said it was $25,000, it was probably going to be $30,000 or $35,000, but it was going to be an affordable vehicle that would probably qualify for, in the U.S., for the federal tax credit, making it extraordinarily popular. However, they backed away from that, probably because profitability would have been an issue. So the thing that's being talked about right now, and the thing that Elon Musk is touting, is a ride-hailing vehicle, which is an autonomous ride-hailing vehicle. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, they're not in a position to build an autonomous, completely autonomous vehicle. And the market for that would be limited relative to selling vehicles to the general public. So that is not an answer to their problems, but that's the answer we're hearing right now.
It's not only obviously the sales, but people investing. This company was worth over $1 trillion, now worth just, quote-unquote, $535 billion. But I know math. That's less than half the value, Tom. That's no good. I'm batting my eyes, but the tears, they aren't just coming, Tom. And it's not an Elon Musk thing. It's a what-did-you-think-was-going-to-happen thing.
Well, and that's exactly the point. I think a lot of people question the Cybertruck, too, which we've been hearing about for a number of years. And the Cybertruck has hit the market, and it's largely disappointing. It doesn't seem to be as capable as other trucks off-road. It's very expensive. The build quality has been dismal by almost all reporting outlets. So that is not an answer. And they spend so much time and development effort and money on the Cybertruck, and it doesn't seem like it's going to fill a slot in the lineup or it's going to help with volume.
630 chimed in with something interesting. I'm curious your take. They say that Musk's behavior has not generated trust in the brand. Many progressive people are the ones who want EVs, so his politics have also hurt his sales. Is there anyone chatting about that being a possibility?
Oh, yeah, that's coming up all the time. In fact, just this morning I was on Twitter or X, and he's working on a town hall meeting with Donald Trump. And again, Donald Trump, very much anti-EV, and his audience obviously would be slightly more progressive, slightly more EV and more green-minded. So it is a huge contradiction that is turning people off.
Are we being too negative? I mean, Elon Musk has built a lot of companies up, done some great things in the business world. Is there a way out of this? Are we being too negative?
The way out of this probably is for Tesla to build something relatively soon that is more mainstream. Kia, for example, just launched the EV9, and this is a large mid-sized three-row crossover that's all electric with more than 300 miles of range. That's where the market is now, and Tesla doesn't have anything like that. And I think Tesla has been, in the past, reluctant to build something that's just a little too common or too obviously something that fits into the market scheme, but they need to do that now. As you said, Elon Musk, obviously brilliant because he started an electric car company, which no one else has been able to do.
Right.
So he got us this far. He did this, but now he seems to be imploding. It's a weird thing to watch.
Any question you got for Tom Appel about cars, I can think of no one else who would answer it as well as he will. 312-981-7200. Call now. All right, we're all warmed up for the Wintrust Business Minute with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Civic Boosters have launched a new campaign to promote co-working spaces and iconic locations in an effort to attract workers back to downtown Chicago. Cranes Reports World Business Chicago and Penny Pritzker's nonprofit, P33, have launched the Work From Summertime Shy initiative. The goal is to attract remote workers to co-working spaces at places like Navy Pier, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Chicago Cultural Center. It's hoped the initiative will bring $10 million in economic impact to the Loop and surrounding areas by reminding remote workers of the charms of downtown Chicago. The initiative comes as the downtown Chicago office vacancy rate rises to 25%. Subscriptions to Chicago-based Grubhub will be included with Amazon Prime memberships moving forward. Membership will permanently include a free subscription to Grubhub Plus as part of a deal announced this week. The inclusion of Grubhub Plus had been temporary until now. Grubhub Plus includes zero delivery fees on orders over $12, along with reduced service fees and a 5% credit back on pickup orders. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, Business of Food, Lindsay Tobin.
A long time ago, in a field far, far away, John Deere came to an agreement with SpaceX, allowing the ag tech giant to connect to SpaceX's satellite technology, providing cutting-edge connectivity services to farmers around the world.
And liftoff.
You know, really what we see with this solution is we're going to continue to augment and use satellite connectivity where we can, but in instances where we can't, we're going to have the Starlink terminal on these machines for customers that want it, and it's going to provide that ubiquitous, that full-fledged 24/7 real-time level of high-speed internet connectivity on those machines to connect them where they just haven't before.
This partnership is an industry first in 3.5 years in the making. Their research found that nearly 30% of the United States is lacking in connectivity in rural areas.
It's going to be impactful. This is going to allow them once and for all to trust the connectivity that they have in their area.
This partnership not only connects the machines, but connects a farmer's entire operation.
We can track that data across the entire field, right, and create a yield map for them at the end of the year. That's really their report card for how well they did, right? And they can use that to make tweaks.
Doing more with less, all aimed at minimizing critical downtime and meeting future food supply needs.
By 2050, there's going to be 10 billion people in this world. We're going to have to produce 50% more food on the same amount of land, if not less land, than we are today.
John Deere says this will help farmers across the world be more efficient, more productive, and more profitable.
With the Business of Food, I'm Lindsay Tobin for WGN.
Tom Appel, Consumer Guide Automotive. You ready for some car questions?
I would love some.
Thank gosh, because I would not be able to tackle any of these things. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff, what is your question?
I had a question. I was looking for a mid-sized SUV, kind of a more of a top-rated one. I wasn't interested in Hyundai or Kia, but I was kind of looking at Mazdas. I didn't know what you thought of those.
All right, Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, the Mazda CX-90, which is relatively new, just joined by a CX-70, which is similar. Very nice vehicles. They're a little bit expensive because Mazda's been trying to push its whole model lineup upscale, but they're kind of worth it. These are largish crossovers, three-row crossover, very customer-friendly. They're rear-drive based, which is interesting. That's kind of a change for Mazda. So they're a little sportier in character. They're available with inline sixes that are turbocharged, and if you want, plug-in hybrid. I like them a lot. They're very nice in size. And if that seems a little pricey to you, the Toyota Highlander is always a great pick.
Jeff, thanks for calling, okay?
Thank you.
Let's go to Nanette. Nanette, what do you got?
Hi, Tom. Hi, John. So we're a family of four. We have two teenagers. One's going to college. And we're looking for a roomy second row, reliable, with maybe some space in the back for, you know, bringing his stuff to college or, you know, if we're going on a trip. So we have been a Mazda family up to now. But we're just getting tired of Mazdas, so we're looking for something new.
You want a new logo on the car. There you go. Yeah.
Right.
Tom, any thoughts? You just gave us the Mazda, but she don't want it.
Yeah, and again, I recommend the Toyota Highlander highly. Lots of space. And there is a Highlander. There's new a Grand Highlander, which has more rear seat space and surprisingly does not cost much more than the Highlander.
Right. Nanette, that's a good recommendation for you.
And yeah, by
the way,
you.
Yeah, for sure. 312-981-7200 is our phone number, by the way. And before we go to another caller, Tom, during the segment we had with Brian Hogevane, who was the cash man who had gave people items or what they were worth, I kept on asking the callers, what do you got? And I had a few people point out that that is not grammatically correct. So I will say, what do you have next time? But I just did it to Nanette. So apology to all those folks that care about the grammar out there. All right, Tom. 847 wants to know, what is Tom's thoughts on Lucid, the car brand? I had two colleagues buy them recently, never heard of them. They look pretty sharp.
Yeah, Lucid is a startup. It's been around for, five, six, 7 years. They make only a sedan right now, which is their problem, I think. They make a very expensive high-end sedan, and that's not where the market is. I should say they're an EV startup, just to be clear. Here's the thing about Lucid. They have a new crossover coming called the Gravity, and I think that a little patience will see this company succeed because they really need a crossover. Also, they are backed in part by the Saudi Growth Wealth Fund, so I think that the Saudis very interested in investing in things other than oil, and they like alternative energy, will invest more in this company before they let it fail. So I think Lucid has a very good chance of succeeding.
Someone wanted to know is, what are our negotiation stance right now? Is there any room for negotiation with cars right now?
Yes, actually, great question, because this situation seems to have changed dramatically this year. But the supply of vehicles on the ground is rising quickly, which means that the supply lines are filled, lots are full, and dealers are starting to negotiate. And there was one estimate, and I cannot remember the company that made this estimate, that incentives will reach as much as $3,000 per vehicle by the end of the year. So yes, you can negotiate. Yes, there are incentives and rebates. And yes, this is a good time to buy a car.
Are interest rates really high for car loans still? I imagine so, if that's where they are everywhere else.
Yeah, that's still a problem, unfortunately, and it is keeping people at home. But the prices are coming down, which sort of mitigates that.
I got a dumb question, Tom. Never wondered this. But for a mortgage, you can rent the rate by the house. Like if you can get a why can't I think of the word right now? You can get the new mortgage. What am I saying, Tom? Were you
refinance?
There it is, refinance. Yeah. Can you refinance a car loan?
You can. It's complicated, and usually your lender's not going to be in a big hurry to help you do that. So you need to just get another loan and pay off that loan yourself.
I host a program called Your Money Matters, and I couldn't think of refinance. So I'll study a little bit more before our next show Monday. 847 wants to know, Honda seems to be lagging behind to get a new product on their lot. What's causing this? We've been in the market for a new CR-V since the pandemic. We've been on hold for like 3 years.
The CR-V, we were just talking about how many cars are in the pipeline, but the Honda CR-V and the Toyota RAV4, both super popular compact crossovers, and they're popular for a reason. They're excellent. The pipeline is still a little bit shy of those, so you're going to have a harder time getting one of those. And even if you find one, it may not be the color or the trim level you want.
Okay, 847's on the fence. I'm trying to decide whether I want my third Nissan Rogue or if I want to go with the Ford Bronco Sport.
Oh, wow. The Bronco Sport, super popular right now, partly because it's cute and it's adorable and it's fun to drive. Big difference, though, the Rogue is so much roomier and the ride quality is so much better. If you like the Rogue and you've been in the Rogue, I don't recommend a change. If you're looking for something kind of young, kind of small, kind of sporty, maybe go to the Bronco Sport, but I think it would be a jarring transition.
Can you ask Tom about the Volvos? Oh, we just lost Tom Appel. Okay, now we're almost done with this segment anyways. Tom Appel is wonderful. He's from Consumer Guide Automotive. He always has all the answers to everything. He does the Car Guy podcast, too. We're going to try and get him on, Pete, you think? Or yeah, okay, we'll try and get him on. I'll stall here for a little bit. 312-91-7200 is our phone number. Yeah, Tom, frequent guest on Your Money Matters. Tom is here. We got one more minute, Tom. You ready for a couple more questions?
Sure.
Any tips about negotiating a price?
Yeah, the great thing now is we have the internet. You don't even need to go to a dealer. Dealers have dedicated internet salespeople who will work to get you a price, and you can play two or three or four dealers against each other. We're lucky that we live in Chicago and that there are all sorts of dealers all over the place, so we can play that game. So be patient, and you can negotiate.
What about the Volvo XC60 T5 and T6? I have no idea what I just read.
Those are Volvo's midsize crossovers. They're excellent cars. They're getting a little bit old, but there's nothing there not to like. A little bit pricey with options. So there are other things you can look at. I really like the BMW X3 and X5, so check those out.
I love that. What about the new Prius? 20 seconds.
Awesome. The new Prius is awesome. It's sporty, it's good-looking, still gets the great mileage, and it's so affordable compared to a crossover. Absolutely look at it.
Consumer Guide Automotive, host of the Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast, consumerguide.com. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.